Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. On today's show, we're going to meet an original Tuskegee Airman who grew up here in Minneapolis, discuss Suicide Prevention Month with the Minnesota National Guard, and check in with the Minneapolis VA Healthcare Center. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
September 18th marks the birthday of the United States Air Force, the Aerial Warfare Service Branch of the United States Military. It's time to reflect on the great history of the Air Force. World War II had been over for 2 years, and the Korean War lay 3 years ahead when the Air Force ended a 40-year association with the United States Army to become a separate service. The mission of the United States Air Force is to fly, fight, and win in air, space, and cyberspace. To achieve that mission, the Air Force has a vision of global vigilance, reach, and power. That vision relies on developing airmen, technology to warfighting, and integrating operations. The Air Force has come a long way since its formation in 1947, and the excellence and tradition are carried on in Minnesota by the Minnesota Air National Guard's 133rd Airlift Wing and the 148th Fighter Wing. With the increased emphasis on cyber warfare, I am confident we'll see the Air Force and the Air National Guard progress even further in our generation and generations to come.
Thank you, General Nash. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Joining us now is one of the original Tuskegee Airmen who grew up here in Minneapolis. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Harold Brown, and he served his country for 23 years, including serving in World War II in Korea. Retired in 1965 at the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. Colonel, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you for the invitation.
Sir, you had a great career in the military, but I want to go back to your roots. You grew up right here in Minneapolis.
Right here on the north side of Minneapolis.
And how was it back in those days when you were just about getting ready to graduate and there was a war afoot? And what was your thinking back then, sir?
Well, those were during the days of the Depression. A bunch of poor folks. I can recall we never locked the front door because there was nothing worthwhile even being stolen. But let me give you a little history, my history. My mother always wanted me to play the piano, and I didn't really have any talents, but mothers have a strange way of seeing talents that don't exist in their children. Well, that went on until I was about 11 years old, and that's when I fell in love with an airplane. And I told my ma, I want to be a pilot. And she looked at me, and in those days, no one, you know, wants to be a pilot. You hear a little putt-putt coming over, and everybody looks up at it. So I said, oh, yeah, Ma, this is what I want. She says, no, the piano stool. So I was arrogant. I would just sit on it and close my hands. I said, I'm not going to practice. Well, after a while, the teacher said, Mrs. Brown, he's not practicing, so you're just wasting money. So that was the end of my piano career. Then in about, like I said, I was about 11 years old in the sixth grade, fell in love with airplanes, started building all the models, everything, read every book I could find up in the library. I can remember one book, Randolph Field, Texas, West Point of the Air, and I read that book so often I can almost memorize it. If we continue until I hit about 16 years old in the 11th grade, I saved $35. My uncle took me out to Wold Chamberlain, and I found a fixed-base operator that gave me five lessons, $7 a lesson, dual instructions for five lessons, hoping that I would have more money to finish it, but it didn't. So the first five lessons ended. Now, during those years, they always wanted college graduates in the military, but they rapidly ran out of the pool, so they came up with the idea, well, look, if we'll take high school kids, because they needed pilots, in the worst way.
World War II was a world at war. They needed everybody.
They did. And I graduated 17 years old, 1942, from North High School. I immediately went down, set for the exams, passed my physical, and then I had to wait. All of the other ones that looked a little bit different than I looked, they were all sworn into the reserve. So the draft couldn't touch them, and they were just waiting for a class start. My name had to go to Washington, D.C., where that's where they made the selection for us guys. And
so you're telling me that back then the path for a black man to become a pilot in the military wasn't a very easy route.
It was a little different, and it took an awful lot of luck because there were many, many guys who were drafted waiting to hear from Washington, D.C., have I been selected or haven't I been selected? I got a letter in December of 1942, said I had been selected. From that time on, shortly after there, I had to enlist in the military with instructions. They sent me down to Biloxi, and this is where they were sending many, many guys for basic training for the first 5, 6, 7 weeks. And it's interesting, 600 of us arrived, and they retested us. And I said, well, this is odd, because it looked pretty much like the test I had already taken. They washed out 300 of us, and only 300 of us were selected to continue from that point.
So they took the best 300.
Well,
and you made it.
I made it. I don't know if we were the best, but I made it. So we were there for approximately 6, 7 weeks, then up to Tuskegee. Because for guys who they brought in, they developed another program called College Training Detachment for the high school kids. So we did that. That went anywhere from 4 to 6 months, depending upon your grades that you made on the test. So I was in that for about 4.5 months. And then I went over to Tuskegee Army Airfield, and that's when I finally became an aviation flying cadet.
So that airfield, Tuskegee Airfield, was the source of the name Tuskegee Airmen.
That's where it all comes from.
Which was a group of all black pilots.
Right. And Tuskegee Institute at that time was very well known. And they're the ones who lobbied, and they got the program. And they had the best civilian pilot training program going anyway. So it was the most logical place for them to put it. And there's where it all started.
So, sir, how long did it take before you had enough training so you could go off to war?
Well, after I got there, I was in the flight training program, lasted approximately 40 weeks, and then 2.5 months of fighter training. That concluded around in September. And about that time, they put us on a boat, 32 days on the boat to Rocca Gibraltar, then up to Oran for 3 days, and up to Naples for another 3 days. And finally, over the Ramitelli, which was on the Adriatic coast, we finally arrived some 6 weeks after we graduated. And I graduated in May of 1944.
Sir, that all sounds pretty exciting, but it must have been a little scary, too.
Well, we were young and eager, and this is why I understand they send young men off to war. They think they're invincible until they find out differently. So
it was exciting until you got
there. Oh, it was very exciting. We were all eager beavers. We all wanted to fly, and we were gung-ho.
Sir, we're gonna have to take a short break, but before we do that, the history books show that the Tuskegee Airmen were exceptional protectors of our warplanes, of our bombers. What made you guys so much better than the rest?
We had a commanding officer, Benjamin O. Davis, Jr., a West Point graduate, graduated in 1936, who became our commander, and he was all business. When General Akers asked him, how would you like to come over to the 15th and do escort duty, he did flip-flops and said, just what I've been waiting for. And General Akers told him, we are losing bombers like crazy, and it's primarily because the fighters are not sticking close enough to the bombers. They're going off looking for victories. And
they're going off trying to shoot the enemy fighters.
That's it. B.O. Davis, when I first came in, welcome, gentlemen, to the group. I got one rule. If you ever leave a bomber to go off looking for victories, you can get 10 victories. When you come back here, I'm going to court-martial you, and you'll never fly another airplane again.
He got your attention.
He got our attention. And we stuck with our bombers up over target, bring them all home safely. That's what we were supposed to do, and that's just what we did. Matter of fact, they got to the point where they call us the Red Tail Angels, the Bomber Boys.
So the bomb groups at first were pretty skeptical.
They didn't know who these guys were flying these red tails. Who are these new guys? Because we were a new group.
But pretty soon they found out if they wanted to survive, they wanted you guys.
As a matter of fact, they begin to request us. So what does B.O. Davis? He renames his airplane by request.
Very good, sir. Colonel, we have to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the war in Europe and the Tuskegee Airmen and a book that you've written about your experience. We're talking to retired Lieutenant Colonel Harold Brown on Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons, and we've been speaking to one of the original Tuskegee Airmen, retired Lieutenant Colonel Harold Brown, about his time in World War II and in fighters. And he's in Minneapolis on a book tour because he and his wife co-authored a book called Keep Your Airspeed Up, The Story of a Tuskegee Airman. And Colonel, how long did you and your wife wrestle over writing this book and editing? And she probably made you clean up some of the stories, didn't she?
A matter of fact, that came as close to costing a divorce as anything you can imagine.
Oh, no.
But it took a lot of hard work. It took her roughly 3 years to write it and many rewrites. We would argue over a section. She had a friend, a historian, who was read every chapter, and he would look, Marsha, this isn't quite right. Well, this is what Harold said. Well, then Harold's wrong, and such as such. He's embellishing some of these stories. And I admit I might have embellished a few of them, but... You know, a little embellishment doesn't hurt anything.
And of course,
but they had to be corrected.
And she's a PhD, and she's an English major, and
that's right.
And you were a fighter pilot.
That's
so that adds
correct.
Up. That adds that up pretty well.
That makes a difference.
But also, sir, I understand that you also went on to earn a PhD, retiring from Columbus Technical College, and retired from Columbus Technical College as a vice president of academic affairs. So
yes.
You could handle your doctor wife, couldn't you?
Well, up to a point, but I knew when to cut it off.
Well, after all these years, I hope you do, sir.
Yes.
Sir, I want to go back to World War II. Your Tuskegee Airmen were flying the fighter pilots, and your charge was to protect those bombers. And unlike a lot of the other fighter squadrons, you stayed with the bombers and took care of the bombers. And eventually those bomb groups were requesting you, which is probably the reason that you've got such a great record. You were telling me off the air that something happened in your 12th mission.
Yes. The Germans, right towards the end of the war, developed the first jets that became operational. And they had one jet, which was their primary jet, the ME-262. It was a twin-engine jet. Very, very fast, 75, 100 miles an hour faster than the P-51. But if you saw them, you could outmaneuver them because they were going so fast, you could turn inside of them and all the rest of it. But they were the primary threat against the bombers, because they would come in at a high rate of speed and go right through the bomber formation. And the only thing way we could stop them is we could time our turn right so we could attempt to break them up and not run through the bomber formation. And on my 12th mission, something like that happened. They came in, my wingman and I fell in behind one. He saw us, and he broke off, and we broke off with him. And I had him in my sight and shooting like crazy, and I was hollering, wingman, shoot, we might get in a lucky shot before he gets out of range. Well, he was out of range, but we kept following him and kept shooting, which was stupid on our part. But I call it the exuberance of youth. We just didn't use good judgment. Well, long story short, we're going back home. We get separated in the clouds. I have fuel exhaustion. And so here I am, 25,000 feet, no engine. But I knew I was in friendly territory. So I spotted the little landing strip, which had been made inoperative by a great big ditch. So now I got 2,000 on the front side or 2,000 on the back side. And it's bad enough trying to stick this airplane with 4,000. So now I'm working with two small 2,000-foot strips. Well, I got it down all right. I crash landed. It tore the airplane to pieces, but I got out. And there's an old story. Any landing you walk away from is a good landing. So I had a fantastic landing.
Yeah, a little bit too excited that day on that mission.
Yeah.
Well, those things happen, as you say. And, Colonel, something happened on your 30th mission that you'll never forget.
Yes. Now, that one was something. Now, we were on a strafing mission, and we were strafing from Linz, Austria, 100 miles southeast. And it was a special 15th Air Force mission. We knew that this was a very, very heavily traveled area. But the bombers, they would see you go over, and they knew when you were coming back. And they could time it pretty right, and they would put all the trains in the tunnel. We come back and look down, no railroad traffic. So the 15, well, we'll fix that up. So they gave the 332nd the mission, a strafing mission. They gave it to the 99th, and we took off early in the morning, 21 airplanes, and caught them all out in the open. And it was a fantastic day. All kinds of chatter. I blew up this one. You see that one blow up? And, oh, it was really a great mission. We finished the mission, and it's always the last one. Major Camel, I was flying his wing, the squadron commander said, Harold, we missed one. Let's go get him. The rest of you guys wait for us. So we go down on him. He starts shooting. I could see he ran out of the ammunition. He broke off. So I went in on him, and I had it lit up like a Christmas tree. Every time you hit, those 50 calibers would blink and twinkle back at you. Well, just as I decided I got to get out of here, and just as I pulled up, that's when it blew up. And when it did, some of the debris from the exploding locomotive damaged my 51, and it only ran for another 2 or 3 minutes. I lost the engine, so turned it up, bailed out of the aircraft, and as I was in my chute, the guys circled me, and I could hear those airplanes going home, and I said, what am I doing up here? I landed in the snow, 20 years old, looking like this. I got no business in Germany. Well, I was picked up by two constables. They took me back to a village, and we were met by an extremely angry crowd. And they had one thing on their mind. They wanted a piece of me, murder. And rightly so. You know, shrapnel's flying over the place. Shrapnel could have killed a guy's wife, his child. They had a right to be angry. So I knew I was going to die that day. I was helpless. I couldn't run, no place to hide. And I was going to die, and I knew it. And Constable Way in the back came forward. I didn't pay any attention to him. He stepped in front of me, put a round in his rifle, and kept the people from killing me. We backed up into a little pub, went inside, barricaded ourselves. Around midnight, the crowd had dispersed, and we go out, and they turned me over to soldiers, and I finally wound up in a POW camp. But can you imagine that guy right there, knew everybody in that crowd, good friend, some of his relatives.
Risked his life to save him.
In that crowd. And I always said, at a later time in my life, I got to go back and find that guy and say thank you. But more than that, I wanted to ask him, why did you do it? Why did you risk your life to save me, a pilot who you knew nothing about? I was your enemy.
And the answer would have been, it was the right thing to do.
But I never made the trip, and I'll regret that for the day that I live.
So, sir, how long did you stay in the POW camp before you were freed?
Well, actually, I was only in there for a couple of months. So I wound up in Nuremberg. The Americans were getting close. They marched us out 2 weeks down to Moosburg, about 30 miles north of Kilometer, and that is where Patton came through on April the 29th and liberated. Of course, that was the end of the war for us. But the war ended on the 4th or the 5th, about a week later than that.
So you were done flying the P-51s then?
At least for the time being, until I got over into Korea. And then I was flight testing 51s.
And your resume here says that you eventually flew 20 different military aircraft in your career.
Yeah, and that was primarily because I was doing flight test work over in Korea. And everything, every aircraft we repaired, we had the flight test. So I flew all of the straight-wing jets, F-80s, 84s, 86s, 94s. We were doing it for the Army, L-5, 16, 17, L-19s, L-20s. I was current in the C-47, the DC-3, the C-45, and it goes on and on. The greatest flying experience I could have ever had. And I was very, very fortunate. Nowadays, you're lucky if you fly 3 airplanes, you're lucky if you fly that many. And here I flew 22 different airplanes.
What a terrific career, sir. And you've written a book about it called Keep Your Airspeed Up, The Story of a Tuskegee Airman, all about the retired Lieutenant Colonel and Dr. Harold Brown, co-authored with his wife, Dr. Marcia Bordner. And Colonel, we've just got about 30 seconds left for all our listeners all over Minnesota. If they were thinking about a career and wanted to learn how to fly, what would you tell them?
Well, I talked to a lot of youngsters, and I got several things for them. Dream, aim high. Go after your favorite dreams. But understand this, there are no free rides. You're going to have to work. But if you work, if you persist, use your head, hey, you can become anything you want to become.
Colonel, I appreciate your taking the time to join us today on Minnesota Military Radio.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you, sir. That was retired Lieutenant Colonel Harold Brown on Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. When we come back, we're going to talk about Suicide Prevention Month. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. In a moment, we're going to discuss Suicide Prevention Month with the Minnesota National Guard. But first, it's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly update from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Commissioner Larry Chaletot.
The gold star symbolizes the loss of a loved one while serving in the armed forces of the United States, whether it be in combat or duty other than combat. Gold Star families have given so much and continue to give back to the community through voluntary acts. In bearing the loss of a loved one, Gold Star mothers, fathers, spouses, and their families truly understand the cost of this country's security and freedom. The family members of our fallen have earned the utmost respect and undying gratitude of our nation and our state.
Thank you, Commissioner Chaletot. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. In this segment, we're going to talk about R3SP and Suicide Prevention Month. And R3SP in the Minnesota National Guard stands for Resilience, Risk Reduction, and Suicide Prevention. And joining us today to talk about this is the officer in charge of that program, Captain Troy Davidson, and First Sergeant Jeanette Chafee, who began working with R3SP, Resilience, Risk Reduction, and Suicide Prevention Program in 2011 as the Suicide Prevention Program Manager. Captain, First Sergeant, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Tom. Appreciate the opportunity.
First Sergeant, we're going to start with you. How long have you been in the military?
Tom, I've been in for just a little over 15 years now.
And you already made it to First Sergeant.
I already made it to First Sergeant. Right places, right time.
That's pretty good. And it sounds like you volunteered to be part of the suicide prevention program about 6 years ago?
About 6 years ago, yes, Tom.
What led you to this, First Sergeant?
Well, I was approached by people from the deployment cycle support group that used to exist about an opportunity to help out the suicide prevention program because there were lots of new changes coming about and they needed additional help. So no experience in suicide prevention other than what the Army has given me, but saw it as a great opportunity to help change the program and maybe get better program training opportunities out there for soldiers, as well as hopefully helping to save lives within the National Guard.
So you're happy with that choice?
I am.
Good. And Captain, you're the officer in charge of the R3SP program. How long have you been in the military, sir?
I've been in about just over 8 years at this point, Tom.
And how long have you been involved? How long have you been officer in charge of R3SP?
I will be a year this October, actually. And then prior to that, I was in charge of the Substance Abuse Prevention Program, which is kind of a sister team to the R3SP program.
So, sir, can you explain to us what is this program all about? It's resilience, risk reduction, and suicide prevention.
Yeah, so with respect to resilience, we are basically in charge of making sure that all our units have the resources they need to carry out resilience training for all soldiers in the Minnesota National Guard. That's an Army requirement that they get training on those resilience skills. Those resilience skills were developed by the active duty Army in collaboration with the University of Pennsylvania 8 or 10 years ago. They really help to develop critical thinking skills, problem solving, interpersonal communication, a lot of those skills that help our soldiers succeed, not just in their military activities, but also in the other 28 days of the month at home with their families, in school, their civilian employment and all that type of thing. The risk reduction, we try to promote healthy living habits, whether it's physical fitness, nutrition, sleep habits, all of those things that contribute to a healthy lifestyle in order to mitigate and reduce risk, which are, a lot of the underlying factors for self-harm or death by suicide. So that's part of the risk reduction component. And then obviously the suicide prevention, the SP in our acronym, we ensure, and First Sergeant Chafee primarily, ensure that every unit has the resources they need to do that suicide prevention training every year. Similar to the resilience training, they have to have that via Army regulation. So First Sergeant Chafee heads up that component of the R3SP. It's an ACE model, Ask, Care, Escort. And she can probably expand a little bit on everything that includes, but that's kind of the R3SP in a nutshell.
So, Captain, life's full of challenges, and it seems like there's a new thing to sort out every day. And if your soldiers go through a rough patch, you want to teach them how to be resilient, how to take a knee for a moment, rest up, get back at it, reduce some risks, such as maybe some excessive drinking or problems such as that. And then I understand the causes of suicide are usually same kind of causes we have in the civilian society of the house, is employment problems, relationship issues, mental health, substance abuse issues, finances. All of those things have to be the same for our soldiers as they are for our civilians.
Yeah, Tom, that's absolutely correct. And, you hear a lot about veteran and military suicide, obviously, in the news and that type of thing. But you're absolutely right that the underlying factors and the contributing causes are the same for, members of the military as they are for the general population, and our numbers reflect that. So we really try to support our service members in all those ways, whether it's their finances. We have personal financial counselors that help with that type of thing. Whether it's relationship, we have, MFLAX, military family life counselors that help with relationship issues. Obviously, our employment, placement services, that type of thing, education. All those things that that contribute to difficulties in life, like the civilian population, we try to make sure that our soldiers have that those support and resources in order to overcome some of those challenges.
We're speaking with Captain Troy Davison and First Sergeant Jeanette Chafee on Minnesota Military Radio. First Sergeant, a lot of your soldiers, unless they're called to active duty and on deployments, you get them 2 days of the month, and then they're home with their family the rest of the month. How do you recognize if they're having some issues when you only see them a couple of times a month?
Tom, so that's the big struggle, right? We only do have them 2 days a month. So the big thing that from us that we try to push out in our program, and that is pushed down from TAG all the way down to the lowest, E1 in the military, is you got to know your soldier. Know what's going on in their life at home and know what's going on in their life in the military. So then that way you're able to identify if they've had something, the mood or behavioral changes within their life, because that's when we know that there's something going on and when we need to step in and take action.
So try to recognize some changes that might have some problem behind them that are causing some issues that you've made it your business to know how to help with.
Yes, Tom, exactly, because everybody in life has risk factors. Nobody's perfect. Nobody doesn't have an argument with a loved one here or there, a financial struggle, sometime in life. We all have some sort of risk factor in our life. And so if we don't know our soldier, we don't know that risk factor has been something that's become overwhelming for them and they're not able to deal with on their own.
Captain, even though I was in the Air Force, I've learned over the last 7 years that the answer to things in the Army side of the house is training, training, training. In this case, it's really true because you've trained a lot of suicide intervention officers.
Yeah, that's right, Tom. And that's a big priority of our program, and First Sergeant Chafee and her team is to train those gatekeepers, as we call them, as suicide intervention officers, SIOs, at every unit to make sure somebody within that unit has some additional training so that they can recognize some of those changes in behavior. Everybody in the unit kind of knows who that person is, so they know who to go to if they are having any issues. So, you're absolutely right. That's a priority of ours.
So, First Sergeant, are you talking to all your soldiers about watch your buddies, watch them, whether they're here or watch them at home, and maybe try to communicate with the families if there's some issue? We have help available. I'm sure you're getting that word out as much as possible.
Yes, Tom. So we, with our social media, we try to push out information. And then also during our reintegration events, family readiness group meetings, we'll try to provide as much information to those family members about suicide prevention, when they're before they go out on deployment, or that reintegration event before they return from deployment. The families get suicide prevention training. We let them know, not to scare them, but to just let them know, hey, these are things that could happen. This is the warning signs to look for. These are risk factors to look for. And if this does happen, here's who to call. Here's what to do. Don't be afraid to ask the question, are you having thoughts of suicide? Even though it's really hard to ask a loved one or a complete stranger that, we have to not be afraid to ask it. So we try to give them enough courage and training so they feel comfortable to ask it.
So for our listeners out there, there's the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, which is 1-800-273-8255. And when you get to that, press 1. There are trained people available that know how to help you. There's programs at the VA Medical Center here in Minnesota. They know how to help. And don't be afraid to have a conversation with your loved one or veteran, because if they proceed without that conversation, you're going to feel bad that you didn't. So sit down and say, is something wrong? Are you having trouble? Do you need help? And if you need help, contact your unit, contact 1-800-273-8255, press 1. Is that the message for Sergeant?
Absolutely, Tom. That's the message. We are trying to empower our soldiers and our family members to know that they could be that power of one. They could be that one person that had that one small conversation that could be the big changing factor in that person still being here today.
Very good. We have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more about Suicide Prevention Month with Captain Troy Davidson and First Sergeant Jeanette Chafee on Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons, and we've been talking to Captain Troy Davidson and First Sergeant Jeanette Chafee about Suicide Prevention Month and about their program that is referred to as R3SP in the Army, which stands for Resilience, Risk Reduction, and Suicide Prevention Program for the Minnesota Army National Guard. And, Captain, I understand you had an event recently, one of your big events of the year?
Yeah, that's right, Tom. So September 10th is World Suicide Prevention and Awareness Day. So last Sunday, our program put on our annual Power of One 5K event, sort of a fun run, ruck, walk event. We had, I think, over 400 soldiers, members of the Minnesota National Guard from four or five different units, as well as 130, 140 civilian citizen members of the community. A great opportunity to sort of share best practices, raise awareness about the issue, and bring together a lot of community partners, stakeholders. That was held out at Arden Hills. It was our kind of record turnout. It was our third annual. So that's what we try to do every year in September, is have that event. Kind of be ready for that next year when we have it. We'll try to make it bigger and better than ever.
Well, give us an announcement next year, Captain. We'll get it on the radio. Sounds like you made them run 5K, and then when they're trying to catch their breath, you talk to them about a wellness program.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, we had a lot of different resources there. Had some folks from an organization that does massage, a little recovery there. We had Ars Bellum that does the art and sort of therapy and a lot of other activities for them, so they could learn about ways to the comprehensive fitness is really the approach. So that it was a great opportunity to bring together various aspects of life there.
So, Captain, with all this training, are your soldiers getting used to hearing about and talking about suicide prevention?
I think they are, and that's the goal, right, is to sort of make folks comfortable, familiar with the signs, and sort of destigmatize it, make people understand that coming forward and seeking help for whatever you're dealing with is a sign of strength and not a sign of weakness, and reducing some of that stigma is really a big priority of ours. So absolutely.
So First Sergeant, for our listeners, to make this work, there's several things that have to happen, but it seems to me the first thing is to watch your loved one and watch your fellow soldier, and if you see some change that just doesn't make any sense, then dig into it a little bit. Is that the first step?
Tom, yeah, that's exactly what it is. So we, in our gatekeeper world, when we are intervening, we call them invitations. So look for those invitations that, you know, whether it's your loved one or somebody you always see on the bus when you're riding into work, you know, as a potential change. Invitations can range from a change in their behavior. So somebody that maybe consumed small amounts of alcohol and are now consuming large amounts of alcohol more regularly. Somebody that was more upbeat, happy all the time, now seems a little bit more isolated, wanting to be alone, and not as happy-go-lucky, essentially, as they were before.
So if you see some change and some maybe a change in behavior, there's usually a cause behind it. Now, First Sergeant, nobody wants to have a difficult chat with a loved one or a friend. And if you think there's a change and they might be thinking about suicide, how do you start that conversation?
So, Tom, that's a very difficult thing sometimes, right? When we're training our soldiers, we tell them, you know, you cannot be afraid of what the losing of that friendship, of that losing that person of being your battle buddy, because they get mad at you because you ask them, are you thinking about suicide? So it's, if you have that gut feeling that something's not right, it's never the wrong thing to do to ask, are you thinking about suicide? If the answer is no, you move on with the conversation. If the answer is yes, then you sit down and you talk to them more about suicide and why, what's going on in their life to put them at being suicidal.
So just think, you might be saving a life. So let's have this difficult conversation. And if you're wrong, apologize. If you're right, take the next step and let's find some help.
Absolutely, Tom.
And Captain, help is available.
Help is absolutely available. Yeah, that's right, Tom. You know, whether it's our internal resources for through our program, you know, our psychological health coordinators or other internal resources you know, resources throughout the community. One of our taglines is there's a lot of resources out there. The challenge is connecting the right person with the right resource at the right time. So that's kind of what we try to do and make sure people know about it, raise awareness and that type of thing. So absolutely.
And we know how to help. The VA hospital has trained experts that can get you in and get you in a program and get you back on life and get you thinking about good things again.
Yep, absolutely. And that's kind of the call to action to those listeners and members of the community out there. There's a lot of ways to get involved, whether it's through the Yellow Ribbon Network or volunteering, that type of thing. There's a lot of ways that members of the community can participate and support members of the military, not just the National Guard, but also veterans from various eras. So a lot of opportunities out there.
Captain Davison, First Sergeant, keep up the good work, and thanks for joining us today on Minnesota Military Radio.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Thank you for having us.
For our listeners out there, if you know have a loved one, whether they're a soldier or civilian, the national hotline is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Expert help is available. Don't be afraid to call. And thank you for joining us today. Joining me now from the Minneapolis VA Healthcare System is Director Patrick Kelly. Director Kelly, welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thanks very much, Tom. It's good to be back with you.
I understand you're opening the Veterans East Housing.
Yeah, across our campus on the other side, sort of where our original hospital was when we built it way back in the 1920s, we are opening a new, what we're referring to as Veterans East, which is a 100-unit apartment community with veterans preference for housing. And this is, again, federal government-provided property and a long-term lease arrangement. Our partner being developed by the Community Housing Development Corporation, and a $14.3 million project and you know, public-private sector partners, and another example of our efforts to eliminate homelessness amongst veterans. And so the 20th of September, less than a week from now, at 1 p.m., we are opening this. It's open to the public, but we're going to have a ribbon cutting over there. But that'll be our second housing unit over there. So it's, again, important deal. We're still trying to eliminate veterans' homelessness, still addressing that. Made good progress, but there's still a lot left to be done. So that's our next effort.
Director, we've read a lot over the years about scheduling problems at some of the VAs around the country, and I understand that you're going to be one of three VA sites that are going to be launching a one-year pilot of checking out self-scheduling tools for our veterans.
Yeah, so this is something that, you know, online scheduling is not, we're a little behind on that in the VA. You know, many other private hospitals, in fact, when I was in the DOD, we were doing this at several of the hospitals that I was involved in. And so this particular project is a one-year pilot to include self-scheduling for veterans. It's under the Faster Care for Veterans Act. Senator Klobuchar, Congressman Paulson, they were involved in getting this passed. Three sites, Minneapolis, Bedford, Mass., and Salt Lake City. And so what's going to happen is that veterans are going to be able to schedule, modify, or cancel appointments in some select areas, primary care, audiology, optometry, and mental health, from their mobile device. And so we are having the contractor out here. We're going to hook veterans up with the app. You know, teach them how to use it. They can view appointment availability real-time online, and that will preclude veterans from having to call the call center or the clinic to get an appointment in those areas. It's going to help us because, you know, again, we have a lot of veterans competing to get through on our phone lines to schedule their appointments. So it's good for veterans. You know, you can't sleep at night. You wake up in the middle of the night, you want to schedule your medical appointment, there's your chance. And so, you know, good for veterans, good for us, and really is the way that healthcare is going. So I anticipate we are going to be doing more and more of this. This is a pilot, but it will definitely be continued and something that we're going to expand.
Sir, we just got a few seconds left, but you've got a Veterans Town Hall coming up on September 28th in Hibbing.
In Hibbing. This is, we're going back up north. Every quarter we hit one site, either in the metro or outstate. And so September 28th, Hibbing Memorial Hall building up there, 4 to 6. And we're looking forward to visiting our rural Minnesota friends up north. And there's some real unique issues associated with rural health care. So we're going to be up there along with the cemeteries and benefits folks. So September 28th in Hibbing.
Busy as usual, sir. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir. That was Director Patrick Kelly from the Minneapolis VA Healthcare System. One announcement today for our Minnesota veterans. If you're an experienced pheasant hunter or you'd like to learn or join, join your fellow veterans at the Hugo Yellow Ribbon Network for an exciting day of free food, pheasants, and fun. More than 1,700 veterans have joined this event thanks to the generosity of sponsors. If you're ready to sign up and want to shoot or sponsor a soldier, email charles.haas, that's Haas, H-A-A-S, 27 at gmail.com, charles.haas, 27 at gmail.com. Thanks for listening to this edition of Minnesota Military Radio. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week, Lieutenant Colonel Harold Brown, Captain Troy Davidson, First Sergeant Jeanette Chafee, Director Patrick Kelly. From the Minneapolis VA Healthcare System, Commissioner Larry Shelledo of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally, Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us next week as we meet and learn from one of Minnesota's newest Yellow Ribbon companies. That's coming up next weekend on this station or online anytime at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
Minnesota Military Radio is a production of iHeartMedia, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, the Minneapolis VA, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, and the Minnesota National Guard. Your host is Tom Lyons, founder and owner of Phelan Partners Limited, a merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is a life member of the American Legion, VFW, Vietnam Veterans of America, and the DAV. For podcasts and the latest updates, follow us at Minnesota Military Radio.com.